puckers up for a big sloppy wet one. And to celebrate, in the studio we have Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons of KISS.
Matter of fact, a lot of the bands who used to open up for us were bands that we were fans of. However, as much as we loved some of those bands or appreciated what they were doing, the love fest ended when we hit the stage because we were there to destroy them. And it had nothing to do with how much we appreciated what they were doing or whether we were fans of theirs. We were there to do a job. We were there to let everyone know why we were the headliner. And if we weren't the headliner, we were there to let everybody know why we should be.
Come to think of it, probably the process of putting on the makeup is like putting on war paint. Hi, this is Gene Simmons from KISS. You know that guy your sister likes because I got a slab of meat sticking out of my tongue.
Hey people, this is Paul Stanley with the very best of KISS.
It's a perfect time to explore the breakthrough albums from this long-running, enormously successful, and yet controversial band. Even the music critics, many of whom didn't understand the appeal of KISS, freely admit that it was KISS who established the outsized generation of arena rock and were the architects of the pop metal that ruled the last half of the 80s. But how did the KISS concept get created in the first place? You know, that musical amalgam where the fantasy world of comic book heroes and demons meets the decibel-driven intensity of an overamped electric guitar. KISS co-founder, singer-guitarist Paul Stanley takes us back to his teenage days in Queens, New York.
I was always a huge Anglophile, meaning for those of you that don't know the word, I was enamored of everything British, and I loved all the English bands. Matter of fact, in New York, there was a show on once a week on the radio called The British Hour, where they would play the top 10 songs in England at that time. And that, to me, was like going to church. I wanted to listen to that every week and see what was going on overseas, because the songs that were hits there and the bands that were big over there were not the same bands that were here. Sure, you had the Beatles and the Stones, but there were other bands that were really very, very influential in the start of KISS, and certainly in my direction, and that would be bands like the Pretty Things. Between the Pretty Things, and there was a group called The Move, which were really contemporaries of a kind of Pink Floyd meets The Who, and some Beatles thrown in there. Roy Wood was in that band, and Jeff Lynne. They both left at some point to start a band that became known as Electric Light Orchestra. So those were the bands that I was listening to. Obviously, the Kinks, the Yardbirds, Zeppelin. You know, it just depends on how far you want to go back. But it was always British music to me. I found most American bands incredibly boring, and most of them didn't even know they were on stage because they were either so high on something or other, or they really looked like they had pure contempt for an audience who came to see a show and would see a bunch of people who looked like they just rolled out of bed. So American music and American rock and roll, you know, outside of Elvis and some of the early figures, really held nothing for me.
originally on the Kiss debut in 1974, that's Strutter. Years after Are You Experienced, Kiss co-founder Gene Simmons invokes the memory of Jimi Hendrix when revealing Gene's early favorites.
Boy, I listened to everything. I was a major fan of English bands mostly because American bands looked like the Grateful Dead. You know, while the American music was fine, they didn't pay attention to the visuals. And it was interesting that it took somebody else overseas to take American music and remind us what made it great, which was that when you saw Elvis, he wasn't just singing songs. He was also shaking his hips. He looked pretty good. In other words, he looked like a star. He didn't just sound like one. The hippie movement in America was probably the worst thing that happened to music since, well, not until grunge. And it has nothing to do with the music. All of a sudden, people didn't care about what they looked like on stage. They just didn't look like stars. So the English bands mostly, and it's ironic that Jimi Hendrix, an American invention, couldn't make it in America. You know, this guy happened in England first, and then America took him to his bosom. And everybody in the band was English. That wasn't an accident. And I think Americans, I don't know, we sort of got lost and forgot the idea that Elvis was the starting off point, at least for the white version of what black music really was. And the white version of that stuff was, hey, it's a party, dress up. And then American bands sort of forgot that. You started to have guys that looked more like Jerry Garcia and less like, Jimmy Page and Mick Jagger. And that's why those other bands, you know, became huge. The girls and the guys liked them.
Well, what's interesting about Hendrix is, A, he was surrounded by all British musicians and British handlers. So his perspective was very, very English. And
Gene pointed that out.
Certainly his contemporaries and the people who much closer fit the mold of what he was doing were The Who, who I remember seeing in 1968, and were brilliant and were very much akin to what he was doing. Sure, on the surface, you could have Hendrix or Townsend smashing guitars, but the whole presentation and the whole look was so British that I remember the first time I saw Hendrix, my first thought wasn't, gee, this is a black guy. It was like, wow, this is like a black English spaceman or something.
You wanted the best and you got it! The hottest band in the land, Kiss!
Get your grandma out of here.
I think the clarity comes from the fact that we started off as huge fans of music and huge fans of rock and roll. And in being fans of rock and roll, our first thought was, what is it that we are being cheated out of, or what do we feel is missing in the bands that we're seeing? And that's why we looked at bands that were from England as these groups that really understood the unity of an image and entertaining fans. And that's why clearly none of the Stones visually could be in the Beatles. When you saw the Beatles, you knew that they were a band that meant, you know, to be together. So very much it was about a cohesive look. And we've always believed in giving the money, you know, giving the money back to the audience, and at least in terms of what we give them on stage. And that's something that sometimes we felt cheated out of when we would go to see bands.
We first started playing in very small clubs, but we didn't play many shows. There must have been 3 or 4, and that was about it. And then we started playing bigger shows. So when we first played in clubs, people were busy drinking. We were happy, of course. They let us put on makeup and sing our own songs, because most bands had to do Midnight Hour by Wilson Pickett and Hang On Sloopy by the McCoys, and on and on. And we had a take no prisoners attitude. I mean, it wouldn't be out of the ordinary for us to jump off the stage and go into the audience in full makeup and take people's hands, take the drink out of their hands, and force them to clap. You know, it's Peter Criss actually said an interesting thing. We were putting on our makeup, and it was at a place called The Daisy in Amityville, Long Island. And inside the bar, there couldn't have been more than, I don't know, 50 to 100 people tops. I don't remember who asked the question, but somehow the answer came out from Peter. Let's go out there like we're playing Madison Square Garden.
So let's rock and roll all night and party every day. You show us everything you got. Keep on dancing till the room gets hot. You drive us wild, we'll drive you crazy.
The first three albums didn't capture the Kiss experience, and it was suggested to us, let's do a live album that'll serve as a souvenir and kind of like an audio memento of the show. And it was actually patterned on this package that this British band Uriah Heep had done. And we recorded a series of shows, and lo and behold, that album just exploded, because I think many people who came to see us, and the amount of people who came to see us versus the amount that bought the album was, you know, striking in the disparity and the discrepancy. So when we did go in and record a live album, it just exploded. But we were hungry, determined, and we had a plan for world domination that nothing was going to get in the way of. And if it took three albums in a year and a half, so be it.
It may seem obvious in hindsight, but Gene Simmons of Kiss maintains that deciding to record and release a double live concert album was in no way a guarantee of success back then.
And including the live record, we didn't know about the marketplace. In those days, to put out a live record was death. There was no marketplace for a live record. Not only that, but to put out a double live record was lunacy.
And, you're right. I'd forgotten about it.
Yeah, there's no such thing. And once we brought out Kiss Alive, after that, that legitimized the live record. And after that, after Kiss Alive came Frampton Comes Alive, and everybody came alive. And everybody started putting out live records. We didn't know anything. They thought we were geniuses. We didn't have a clue. But by the way, the same chord struck in us, perhaps, that struck with other people, which was that there's something inherently maybe cohesive, or somehow it's a piece of the puzzle that fits the band and the fans. It feels better together.
You know, rock and roll really is a live medium, and when you go into the studio, it's a different animal. And some bands were luckier than us in the sense that some of the early albums of some of our contemporaries sonically put ours to shame. And that's just the luck of the draw. You wound up with a better engineer or a better producer, because when you're a babe in the woods, you go in the studio and do your part, and it's really a matter of the team that's been assembled, of which you have very little say. So really, we've always functioned much better as a live band. It's almost like a Kiss concert is something I've always likened to an evangelical church meeting. You know, it's this communal gathering to sing the praises of mighty rock and roll. You know, people are up there, you know, shouting hallelujah and getting crazy. So nothing could have been better than a live album, because that really is us in our arena.
I am not stone at all.
From day one, there was really no comparison to experiencing Kiss in concert. They were loud, huge, rude, with attitude. There's a universal fraternity of musicians with a brother and sisterhood of solidarity among performers. But how did the other bands react when Kiss took the stage?
You know, it's a really good question. I can remember we got out of the club days and had our first, quote, arena show. It was in New York City at a place called the Academy of Music, and we were fourth on the bill. It was New Year's Eve, and it was Kiss opening the show before our first album came out, and then a group called Teenage Lust, a local popular band, and Iggy Pop, and then Blue Oyster Cult. And we only played for 30 minutes. But, you know, we never used to have pep talks. I tell you what, we must have been delusional back then and continue to be, because there's always a sense, there was clearly the predator in all of us. And I'm not using this as sound bites because, you know, come to think of it, probably the process of putting on the makeup is like putting on war paint. You know, all of a sudden you're saying, okay, it's time to stop kidding around. If we know what we know, we knew it back then. We knew it immediately as soon as we started putting the makeup on that we were going to go out there. And it didn't matter if the opening band had a guitar player that played a little faster or the drummer was, you know, we were just going to blow them away, period. And we got thrown off tours consequently, left and right.
We had a great appreciation for other bands. Matter of fact, a lot of the bands who used to open up for us were bands that we were fans of. However, as much as we loved some of those bands or appreciated what they were doing, the love fest ended when we hit the stage because we were there to destroy them. And it had nothing to do with how much we appreciated what they were doing or whether we were fans of theirs. We were there to do a job. We were there to let everyone know why we were the headliner. And if we weren't the headliner, we were there to let everybody know why we should be. Well, it's interesting because even in New York City, and we're certainly a New York band, we were never embraced by the other New York bands. There was a scene going on that is long forgotten, this glitter scene, which was kind of, I guess, spurred by the Bowie movement. And there was just a slew of bands hanging out at Max's Kansas City, whether it was the New York Dolls or early members of Blondie and, you know, the like. And we never hung out. We basically came out of nowhere. We would show up at these shows that either we would put on or someone else would put on, and people's jaws would drop because we only existed as this rock and roll band. We weren't part of the hangar out scene, and consequently, we played 10 times better than anybody else. I still remember our first show in a loft. It was during the day. It was some sort of factory, and at night, once a month or so, they would put on, you know, it would get rented out and a big show would be put on. And when we showed up in the afternoon, the headlining band, a band called The Brats, whose claim to fame, I guess, was that they had beautiful shag haircuts and looked like they came out of England, but they all had rather ethnic names. We showed up, and certainly we weren't the coolest looking guys off stage, and we showed up with all our gear. And they basically didn't give us the time of day, and we said we wanted to do a sound check and set up our gear and played a few of our songs. After we finished playing and after they had put their jaws back where they belonged, we suddenly had new friends. You know, it was always interesting that no matter what somebody thought before we hit the stage, afterwards there was a new reverence. When we left the stage and half the audience left with us, we had new best friends again. So usually hitting the stage was the best way to make friends out of the non-believers, both in the audience and on stage.
Do all
Coming up next, Paul Stanley of KISS reveals that thinking like a rock and roll fan was, is, their tried and true formula, while Gene Simmons makes a compelling case for diversity. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and you can find out a whole lot more here at inthestudio.net 24/7. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley for the Best of KISS.
Hey people, this is Paul Stanley with the very Best of KISS. What a trip. It's healthy to be feared by a certain segment, and often it's just adults and parents in general, because they know the power of rock and roll because they grew up with it also. So it's not surprising that when rock and roll is in its purest form, whether or not it's wearing makeup or a gold lame suit, you know, whatever it takes, it makes waves and it's feared. Over the years, though, it's impossible to keep pulling that rabbit out of the hat. The shock value over time will dissipate, and at some point it has to, you know, stand up on the music and the show and the merits of those things. However, in the beginning, we were determined to write a new page in debauchery and having a great time. We were well aware of the exploits of Led Zeppelin and other bands, and we were determined, you know, to take advantage. We were a bunch of guys who suddenly were let loose in a candy shop and had incredible sweet tooths. You know, I remember Ozzy has said he never saw as many women around as there were, you know, backstage and at the hotels of KISS shows. So whether it was Bible Belt or Mom and Dad, we weren't out there to offend anybody. We were just out there to do everything the way we thought it should be done, and to have a great time. We were out there to amuse ourselves.
Beth, I hear you calling, but I can't come home right now. Me and the boys are playing, and we just can't find the sound. Just a few more hours, and I'll be right home. I think I hear them calling. Oh, Beth, what can I do? Beth, what can I do? You say you feel so empty, that our house just ain't a home, that I'm always somewhere else, and you're always there alone. Just a few more hours, and I'll be right home to you. I think I hear them calling. Oh, Beth, what can I do? Beth, what can I do?
Gene, how important to KISS leaping from cult hard rock following to this mass appeal icon status that you are were two songs, Beth and Hard Luck Woman?
Well, Beth is interesting because we didn't plan it, which is sort of true. I guess it may have been John Lennon who said, life is what happens while you're busy making plans. So Detroit Rock City was always going to be the song everybody was going to hold up and say, this is a classic KISS song. the B-side in those days used to put the song nobody would pay attention to on the other side. Well, radio stations turned it over. And Paul said it right on the money. Kiss fans didn't like that record. The fans that we had gotten up until the third or fourth record thought we were traitors. Not only did we become traitors, but we had a song called Beth that didn't have any guitars or drums. That was about a guy who was talking with his girlfriend, you know, very un-Kiss-like material that became the biggest single we'd ever had. And so we were even bigger traitors. The irony is that in some bizarre way, we didn't know it at the time, but in some ways, maybe perhaps over time, the secret is maybe you've got to undermine every rule there is. So if the rule is that you're not supposed to wear makeup and walk around on higher heels than your mommy does, well, maybe you should do that. And if the rule is that people expect one thing from you, well, then maybe you break that rule, even if it's your own rule. And maybe Beth, and especially Destroyer, the record it came from, broke all the rules that we wrote for ourselves, including having boys' choirs and symphony orchestras and, yes, ballads. You were not allowed to be a rock and roll band, be Devil's Disciples or whatever they thought we were, and sing ballads. And we basically threw caution to the wind and decided to do whatever the hell we wanted and didn't really think too much about it. And, of course, fans at every turn continued to complain, but, of course, it kept appealing to a larger and larger audience. So in retrospect, to thine own self be true.
It's interesting. I'm listening to what Gene's saying. And, you know, in the beginning, there were critics. There was even a critic at Rolling Stone. These people championed us and just thought that we were the greatest thing since sliced bread until we became successful. Then we needed to be disowned because we had sold out. Everybody wanted us to be their own private band. And critics notoriously love struggling musicians who are selling, 10,000 copies. As soon as you become a platinum act, you've betrayed the art. So, for us, it was always about really pleasing ourselves, because even our fans sometimes get caught in this dilemma, and it's a double-edged sword. They love us because we do things our way, but sometimes they get furious because we're not doing things their way. But we didn't get into this for any other reason except to please ourselves and the people who are at any given time pleased by what we're doing. We've always held to the notion that if you don't like what we're doing, you're certainly free, even as a fan, to not buy it. That's always your right. We just have to do what we feel is best. And God knows we make mistakes, but that's the beauty of being Kiss, is that we do things the way we see fit, and then we live or die by the sword.
If never I met you, I'd never have seen you cry. If not for a first hello, we never have to say goodbye. If never I held you, my feelings would never show. It's time I start walking, but there's so much you'll never know. I keep telling you, hard luck woman. A child of the water, too proud to be a queen. Red, I really love you, I can't forget about you. You'll be a hard-luck woman, baby, till you find your man. Before I go, let me kiss you and wipe the tears from your eyes. I don't wanna hurt you, girl. You know I could never lie. I keep telling you, hard luck woman. You ain't a hard luck woman. You'll be a hard luck woman, baby, till you find your man. Red, the sailor's only daughter. A child of the world.
hard luck woman. Baby, till you find your man. Oh, yeah. Bye-bye. So long. Don't cry. I'm just packing my bags. Whoa, leaving you. Bye-bye.
Hard Luck Woman by Kiss was the biggest Rod Stewart hit he never had. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and a whole lot more here at InTheStudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley. Kiss.
Hey, it's Gene Simmons of Kiss, and I saw Redbeard buying red hair color at the makeup counter at the Walmart in Canton, Texas. And Eclipse coupons.
I thought that was you, Gene.
Like, your reference point to Woodstock, the one great thing about Woodstock is on the same stage you could see Jimi Hendrix and John Sebastian and Richie Havens. That was the greatness of Woodstock was all popular music belongs on that stage.
But that was also the greatness of the rock listener. And I think, unfortunately, rock listeners at this point have really narrowed their taste to a point where it's almost like saying, I will only eat hamburgers. This is all I eat. Where the beauty, perhaps, when we were in a more formative stage was that you would go to a concert and totally understand seeing Woody Herman's orchestra, this big band, and Led Zeppelin, because they were both good.
Well, it's partly media, it's partly people, and you got to tip your hat to brave guys. Aerosmith and Run DMC, that was a brave move.
That was brilliant, wasn't it?
And by the way, that was before white guys were saying, what's up? Because when you really take a look at it, ultimately rock and roll, this whether or not you're running around on stage with a guitar or not, is really all black music anyway. So if you're 15 years old and you're listening to me saying this, you're scratching your head and saying, what's he talking about? Well, in a few sentences, rock and roll started with black people playing blues and talking about their hardships and about all they wanted to do was to take the girl home and rock and roll her all night long. And that's the original reference point. Our forefathers were Little Richard, Chuck Berry, and you know, all those guys. That's what it's all based on.
Yeah.
Yet, would Kiss even have a chance to develop in today's music business? Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons weigh in.
I think the record climate now is very, very tough on bands, but what makes or breaks a band is their own heart and their own desire to rise to the top. And certainly the thing that made Kiss in the beginning and has kept Kiss alive is that nobody will ever decide when we come, when we go, what we do, what we don't. It's the inflexibility within a band and the desire to stick with their own set of rules that will make them. And it doesn't matter about the climate. It may be harder, it may be easier at different times, but I believe totally that the buck stops here. And I'm putting it in my wallet. No, the buck stops here, and it's totally within any band's ability, if they have the goods, to succeed. It's very easy to blame the record company, apathy, the climate, trends in music. There's always room for something great. And if it's not today, then you still have to have the determination to fight it out until tomorrow. It's always up to you.
The disadvantage of bands today is that there seem to be walls in popular music, which is to say that if you're a boy band or a girl band, there's that wall. If you're a rap artist, you've got to do the gangster thing, because if you don't do that, you don't have credibility. If you're doing the teen sort of power, sort of pop punk thing, Blink 182 and so on and so forth, there's that thing. You got to play fast and this and that. There are all these hard and fast rules, so when a new band comes out, it gets pigeonholed. You know, a new set of white guys who go, yo, what's up? And then you got the rap, the guitar thing in the background. Right, they're rap rock. We had an advantage, I think. It was more a little bit sort of the Wild West. We would play on bills with Dr. John and the Raspberries, and it was just, I remember as a kid going to see the Chambers Brothers, which was kind of a, I don't know, soul rock thing, Albert King, and Poco, which was sort of like the Eagles. And you could see Led Zeppelin and the Woody Herman Orchestra on the same bill. And it's unfortunate bands aren't a little bit more adventurous, because I would love to see a concert, whether you like them or not, just for a variety. I don't know, pick two bands. Dave Matthews Band and Celine Dion.
You.
KISS has had struggles over the many years with personnel changes, understandably so. Unfortunately, though, KISS is not the first Hall of Fame rock band to weather controversy regarding personnel changes over a long history.
We've always had the philosophy, by the way, that no one member in the band, not myself, Paul, or anybody else, is going to dictate what the band does. And that's pretty hard, pragmatic, a sober way to be in a band, which is that we never bought into the, I want to get high and stoned and just get up on stage and do whatever the hell I feel. Hey, what the hell? It's only rock and roll. We're closer to an Olympic team. We take it deadly seriously, and that being in KISS is not a birthright, it's a privilege, and had no qualms at all about making sure that if you weren't of sound mind and sound body, if one of us was undermining and not showing up on time the professionalism of what we are, then they shouldn't be in the band. Maybe for a while, maybe until you get your head screwed on right, whatever the point was, we owed it to the fans. When if it says on the ticket, KISS on stage, 9:30, you're damn right we're on stage at 9:30 and we will deliver the goods.
Plus, you know, it's the idea that there are so many fans out there, of which the band members are also, we are fans of KISS, and the idea that any one member might be able to decide what KISS does or how the fans are impacted is just totally unfair. So if somebody reaches a point where they say, I don't want to tour or I don't want to do something, well, then you're faced with the question, does the team go home because someone doesn't want to play ball anymore? You know, certainly in the beginning, we dreamed and hoped that the members who started this would end it together. When that becomes less of a reality, you go, well, wait a minute. This is something that I've put years of my heart and soul into, and it's really not for anyone but those left standing to decide what we do.
I'm on.
Kiss, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the ceremony there in their hometown of New York City. And Kiss takes a victory lap around North America. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests, Gene Simmons and Paul Stamp. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2014. All rights reserved, transcription, Jane Carpenter Brune. Theme song by Andy Timmons. For this and many more In the Studio interviews and live performances with the biggest names in rock, check out inthestudio.net.